It's 9 a.m. and you're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago, the pride of the South Side. Sports Talk Chicago is now on the air. This is John Zaglul, and I'll be your host for the next hour. Today, we have an action-packed show ahead as we talk about yesterday's loss for the Bears, which was quite disappointing if you got a chance to see the ending. The Bears were 1 yard away from tying the game up with 0 seconds left to go in the fourth quarter. They could have forced overtime on a Hail Mary pass, but Kevin White made a catch and stopped 1 yard short of the end zone. So we'll dissect that game because even though the game came down to the final seconds, the Bears had so many more opportunities throughout the game to try and win it. We're also going to preview the MLB World Series, talk some Dodgers and Red Sox, who I think is going to win, who has an edge, because as I've said before, the Red Sox don't have any pitching, so it's surprising to me that they've made it this far, and it's going to be very difficult for them to end up winning the World Series when all you've got is Chris Sale pitching effectively in the starting rotation. Later on, we'll also talk some NBA. As the season opened up last week, we'll analyze the Bulls in their first couple of games and also talk about the Los Angeles Lakers and LeBron James and their problems so far. As I like to say, they're a team of misfits. And we'll get to that and what that means coming up a little later on as well. So an action-packed show. So glad you're here joining us today. Before we get started, let's take care of a little housekeeping. You're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago. Now, you can reach me personally on Twitter at John Z Sports, Instagram at John Zags, and Facebook at John Zaglul. And by the way, if you want to watch this broadcast live, find my Facebook page. I'm on Facebook Live right now, so you got the video feed of me in here, so feel free to check that out as well at John Zaglul on Facebook Live. Now, all music today is produced and performed by TMMRW, and he's on all music platforms, including Spotify and iTunes. So if you like what you've heard so far with that intro and the outro coming up later in the show, make sure to check that out when you get a chance. Now, if you want to contribute to today's show, the phone lines will be open for the next hour as we talk Bears, as we talk MLB World Series, as we talk the Bulls and Lakers. If you want to air your grievances, give me some thoughts or debate live right here on the air, you give me a call at 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. So let's get started today and talk about the Bears in yesterday's very close, surprisingly very close game. Now, it began as a dogfight and a competition for the Chicago Bears yesterday. Heck, they were even leading going into halftime. Yet in the end, ineffective passing, critical turnovers, missed opportunities, and more led to another Chicago Bears loss, and it was quite disappointing there in the end and how it worked out. Now, as I mentioned, in the beginning, it was a pretty darn good game. It was a dogfight. The game was going back and forth. There was a competitive battle between Mitchell Trubisky, of all players, and Tom Brady. Trubisky was hanging with Brady and, you know, going toe-for-toe with him. But the problem for Trubisky was, and yesterday, was that he had some problems with accuracy, and that ended up really impeding his overall game yesterday. His overall passer rating, I mean, his completion percentage was 52%. He was 26 of 50. 333 passing yards, sure, but 2 touchdowns and 2 interceptions. So not a horrible game, but This is what Mitchell Trubisky is capable of. This is what Mitchell Trubisky, this is the Mitchell Trubisky that I expected. I mean, he didn't play that well. And I know that he made up for it somewhat with his rushing. He had 81 rushing yards, but that performance yesterday reminded me of Blake Bortles. And by the way, Bortles yesterday, on an unrelated note, ended up getting benched for Cody Kessler. But Bortles is a guy who somehow finds ways to gain rushing yards. He gets like 50 a game, believe it or not, because he's a mobile quarterback. He can run out of the pocket when it collapses. But his overall sense as a passer, his completion percentage, his ability to find receivers, his accuracy, all of that is not QB worthy, and that explains why he doesn't do well. And the same goes for Trubisky. Yesterday, he went 26 of 50 with 333 yards. So he was unable to find guys when they needed to be found. And when the pocket collapsed, he'd run and gain some yards, and that was nice. But as a quarterback, as a passer, Mitchell Trubisky did not impress me and shouldn't have impressed you yesterday based on his performance. Luckily enough, the Bears had stayed in the game. They did get 14 points off of turnovers from New England, and I think that's what truly kept them in the game. They were able to capitalize on New England's problems early in the first half. There were a couple of fumbles with New England. There was a muff on a punt that the Bears ended up recovering too. So all of that put together ended up helping them. And by the way, this was a stat that was alluded to yesterday in the game. The Bears have 16 takeaways on the year, which I believe is second in the NFL only to the Cleveland Browns at this point. They forced 11 fumbles and recovered 6 of them. We remember the fumble by Cordarrelle Patterson on the kickoff early in the game. That set up the Bears some excellent field position. They ended up scoring. And another by Michelle on the running play. Michelle ended up getting hurt later in the game. But earlier while he was in, he had a fumble, and the Bears capitalized and ended up scoring a touchdown on that play as well. So the Bears did take advantage of what was given to them, and that's not the problem at all. They were able to capitalize off of New England's mistakes. The problem lied in the second half entirely. The Bears did not come out with that same fire as they did in the first half, and that's what impeded their win. That's what had them end up blowing their lead and then blowing the game as the game went down to its final seconds. So it all started in the second half with the blocked punt. And that was something that truly is an anomaly, because listen to this stat. That was the first time the Patriots have recorded a blocked punt and then returned it all the way for a touchdown in 354 games. The last time the Patriots did that was in the mid-1990s, and they did it yesterday against the Bears. That's horrible special teams play. And then, later in the third quarter, Cordarrelle Patterson returns it over 90 yards for a touchdown on a kickoff on top of it. So the special teams play, although it was good in the first half by forcing the fumble on Patterson, they didn't show up to play in the second half. They gave up 2 touchdowns on special teams. I mean, that's unprecedented. That never happens to a team in one game. And because the Bears did that, that truly explains why they ended up losing. You can't be giving up 14 points on special teams plays. I mean, there's no formula in regards to winning when you give up 14 points based on a kick return and a blocked punt that turns into a touchdown. It makes perfect sense as to why the Bears didn't win yesterday. After that second half, after those 2 touchdowns they gave up in the third quarter, they didn't deserve to win the game. And Trubisky, as I mentioned earlier, became a non-factor once you got to the third quarter. I mean, 26 of 50. And before that Hail Mary, which truly inflated his stats because that was like a 55-yard pass, I mean, things weren't looking good for him. The 2 interceptions were atrocious. And, you know, the 80 rushing yards, take it or leave it, I understand. You know, the rushing touchdown, that was unbelievable. Don't get me wrong, that was an athletic play. But you can't overlook the fact that his passing was not good. That's not what a second overall pick should be doing in year 2, in the middle of year 2. I mean, we've given this kid enough breaks. I haven't, but many people have. And it's time to start realizing that he's not that great of a quarterback. Deshaun Watson yesterday led his team to victory, led the Texans to victory. Now they're in first place in the AFC South. And everyone was trashing on Watson because He was coming back off his ACL injury, and everyone claimed that he wouldn't be the same, but he is now. He's recovered. So you can't sit here and tell me that Watson's worse off than Trubisky. Patrick Mahomes has the Chiefs riding high. They're 6-1. They won a huge game on Sunday Night Football. People are commending Patrick Mahomes, and that does come with Andy Reid as the coach, but still. You've got those two guys extremely outperforming Mitchell Trubisky, and it's time that people take notice of that. Yesterday's game is a perfect example. You can't have two interceptions, you can't be completing only 52% of your passes, and expect to win a football game. So Mitchell Trubisky himself definitely hurt the Bears' cause yesterday, and then giving up 14 points on special teams. Those were the two problems. I mean, the Bears had problems defending the run yesterday, comparable to the week against the Dolphins, but once Michelle got hurt for the Patriots and they had to bring in James White, the run game became a non-factor. Now, passing out of the backfield, that's an entirely different story because James White became effective catching checkdowns, catching passes in the flat, sure. But as far as the actual run game, the Bears did a good job at neutralizing that yesterday. So now the Bears stand at 3-3, and I talked about this last week after they lost to the Dolphins. I said, you know, the Bears were leading the division. They were 3-1 for the first time since 2014. That was the year in which Josh McCown caught lightning in a bottle. They were leading the division. And then I said, now that they lost that game to the Dolphins, and you knew that they were going to lose to the Patriots, they're not going to be in a good position. And I said, specifically, that the Bears would end up falling into last place by the end of this New England game. And if you take a look at the standings today, the Bears are 3-3, so it's not like they're out of it by any means. But because of the tiebreaker with the Lions at this point, the Bears are technically in last place in the division. They needed to win that Dolphins game. That was a game they should have won. They needed to beat the Packers. That was a game they should have won. The Bears right now should technically, in all actuality, be undefeated. All three of the games that they've lost, they've been in, they've had leads in, mind you, as well. They've had commanding leads in. The Bears were leading the Patriots yesterday by 10 points at one point. They were leading the Packers by 20 points, and the Dolphins by 10 as well. And each and every time, the Bears come out in the second half after posting a very strong first half and can't get it done. And they blow the game. All three of their losses were resulted in second half problems, second half missed opportunities, second half blown leads. They need to shore that up. You know, if these guys want to be effective later in the year, if they're thinking about playoffs, and I know that it's early to think about that, we should be grateful that the Bears are 3-3 at this moment. But if the Bears seriously want to contend for a playoff spot this year, they have to find a way to close out games in the second half. They can't have teams continually creep themselves back into games. Because if they do that, you know, they're not going to finish 8-8. They're probably going to go 7-9 if that's the case. Because if you can't close games out late in the NFL, you are not an effective team. You are not a team that's going to be making the playoffs number one, and if you somehow do make it miraculously, you're not going to do well. You have to learn how to close out games. That's my one criticism of the Bears. And yesterday against the Patriots, it's not that they necessarily played a bad or mediocre game. They were in it the whole time. But because of their second half problems, because of the fact that they don't know how to close a game yet, they lost that game. They've got the New York Jets next week, another 3-3 team with Sam Darnold, the rookie quarterback. That's a winnable game. That's a game that the Bears actually have to win at this point, because if they drop to 3-4, that's not going to be a good sign, especially after starting 3-1. Three straight losses? Not a good sign for the Bears. They need that win next week to bounce back, get up to 4-3, and stay in the divisional hunt and in the NFC wildcard hunt. And by the way, before we finish up on the Bears, can you believe that Trubisky did complete that Hail Mary, though? I thought that was just miraculous. And, you know, it could be an entirely different conversation we could be having had Kevin White been able to lunge himself into the end zone. Made a great catch on the 1-yard line, Kevin White, of all people, on top of it. But He didn't end up getting in, and what I found problematic there was that he makes the catch and comes down with the ball, and his teammates are standing there, I believe it was Burton and Gabriel next to him, and there was a pile around White to try and push him out of the end zone. Why did no one go help him? Why did no one move the pile back near the end zone and move White into it? It is a bang-bang play, and I understand that, but you'd think there'd be some football instinct there, and you'd think there'd be an idea that, hey, let's push the pile in and try and have him score. So the Bears just, they missed opportunities yesterday. They had too many mistakes. Mitchell Trubisky was not effective, and even though he had that Hail Mary late in the game, overall, he was a non-factor. And when you give up 14 points on special teams, you're not going to win a football game. And that's what happened to the Bears yesterday. Now what they have to do is get back at it, and they have to win next week against the Jets, or else they're going to be in big trouble in regards to playoffs and in regards to the divisional race. So hopefully they could come out and stymie Sam Darnold and his rookie offense and make a statement next week as they take on New York. Did you know there's a website that can give you important information about the radiology test and treatment your doctor has ordered? Radiologyinfo.org guides you through nearly 100 diagnostic, interventional, and radiation therapy procedures in a detailed and understandable way, describing how you can prepare and what you may experience and more. Be informed about your radiology visit. Visit radiologyinfo.org. So Bears talk is over, but feel free to still call in. We'll talk Bears. We're going to get into the World Series here next. The phone number is 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. Call in, air your grievances about the game yesterday, or as we talk about the World Series, if you agree or disagree with what I'm saying, feel free to call in. We'll answer the phone. We'll put you right on the air. So let's get to the World Series. If you missed the NLCS Game 7, what a game it was. The Brewers ended up losing, of course. The Dodgers are in the World Series, but such a great and competitive game. The Brewers had opportunities, too, but as I said before, because of their starting pitching and how weak it was, you knew they weren't going to make it to the World Series, and if they somehow miraculously did, they weren't going to win it. I mean, when Yolish Chacin is your number one starter, you're in trouble. I mean, Chacin's a good pitcher, don't get me wrong. A 15-8 record, an ERA of 3.50. Very solid pitcher, but he is not an ace by any means. If anything, he's a quality back-end-of-the-rotation type guy. Wade Miley did good as well for the Brewers, but again, another back-of-the-rotation type guy. The Brewers had five number four starting pitchers in their rotation. They didn't have a number one or even a number two. There were five number four starters. That explains why they lost in seven games. I mean, when you have Clayton Kershaw come out to close the game for the Dodgers, that just goes to show you how much depth they have in the starting pitching position, and we'll get to that here as we talk about the World Series more and the preview. But when you're allowed to have Clayton Kershaw come out on 3 days rest and close out the game for you to go to the World Series, you know that your pitching is sound. You know that your pitching is solid as a rock. You know it's going to carry you into the World Series and possibly winning it all. And that's what the Dodgers have, and that's the big advantage that the Dodgers have when you compare them to the Red Sox. I'm sick of people talking about the Red Sox and how they feel that, oh, their offense is so good. They've got Mookie Betts, J.D. Martinez. That team has so much firepower that it doesn't matter that their pitching is horrible. Because I beg to differ on that subject entirely. Look at history in regards to teams making the World Series based on offense. Look at the Cleveland Indians, for example, in the 1990s. Albert Bell, you know, Omar Vizquel, Jim Thome. They never won a World Series. They didn't have the pitching. They never won a World Series because they didn't have the pitching. Sure, Albert Bell had 50 home runs and had 50 doubles in a season. And sure, you had Jim Thome who guaranteed you 35 homers a year. But in the end, when you have no starting pitching, you're not going to win a World Series. It's plain and simple. The Indians never won one in the 90s. And coming back to today, the Red Sox are so similar. They have lots of star power. on offense. And you can't argue with that. I understand completely. I mean, when you've got J.D. Martinez out there, they're going to probably DH him in the World Series, but he can't play right field too. Martinez had 43 homers, 130 RBIs, and a .330 batting average. He almost won the Triple Crown in the American League. I understand he's a great player. Mookie Betts, MVP candidate, which I disagree with because he's only played in 136 games, but whatever, he's an MVP candidate. We'll play it that way. .346 batting average, 32 homers, 180 hits. Great player. Xander Bogaerts turned it on at shortstop this year. 23 homers, 103 RBIs. If you told me this time last year that for this coming season, Xander Bogaerts would record 100 RBIs, I would have said you're crazy. But he did it. He had a great year. He improved entirely compared to last year. Bogaerts is a guy who used to focus on average specifically. He'd hit .303 but have like 8 home runs and 200 hits. I compared him to a Starlin Castro. But now, he's finding a way to hit for power. He's driving in runners. That's been a godsend for the Red Sox this year. Andrew Benintendi, in his second year, doing great. Hitting .290. So case in point, the Red Sox have a great offense. They have weapons from 1 through 9. I mean, their only dark spot in their lineup, arguably, is the catching position, because they've got Sandy Leon and Christian Vasquez, both of which are horrible hitters. But the Red Sox play the matchups and use them depending on if the pitcher's a lefty or righty. And that's how they play the matchups. And the catching position is usually very low in the lineup, 8 or 9 for the Red Sox every time. And it doesn't seem to affect them that much. I mean, they won 109 games with two catchers with a combined batting average under .200. So they were able to win despite that problem. But it all goes back to the pitching. It all goes back to the starting pitching for the Red Sox. Rick Porcello, David Price, Chris Sale, Eduardo Rodriguez, and Nathan Eovaldi. Out of all of those players, the only one who would scare me as a batter is Chris Sale. Because Sale is an electric pitcher. Sale is one of the best pitchers in the game today. And although he was injured part of this year, he still went 12-4. His ERA was still 2.11, and he had 237 strikeouts in 158 innings. Imagine if he pitched 200 innings. He would have had 300 strikeouts. Chris Sale, you can only get, though, in the World Series, if you're lucky, 2 starts out of him. Probably Game 1 and Game 4 or Game 5 if it goes that far. The rest of the pitching for the Red Sox is atrocious. Rick Porcello, who won the Cy Young Award 2 years to go in a highly contested battle, which I continue to disagree with, went 17-7, but had an ERA of 4.28. David Price, 16-7, 3.58. And as we alluded to last week, the problem with Price is that once he got paid, he sold out. He was a number one starting pitcher. He was a Cy Young Award winner. He was one of the best starting pitchers in the game of baseball, mind you. And now that he's getting $30 million per year, that entire notion is out the door. David Price sold out for money, which is fine. That's his choice. But because he did that, he's never going to be what he was before. And here's an interesting stat about the Red Sox in the playoffs. You might say, oh, that's the regular season, not the playoffs. David Price in the playoffs has a 5.11 ERA. Rick Porcello, an ERA of 4.22. So those two guys and Chris Sale are your 3 starters. The Red Sox and, you know, teams in the World Series usually aren't going to go with 4, but if they did, it'd be Eduardo Rodriguez or Nathan Eovaldi, both of which have ERAs over 3.3, Rodriguez near 4. So when you've got Chris Sale in 2 games, you've got Rick Porcello and David Price for the rest, you can't win a World Series with that rotation. There's no way. You can't have 2 guys with ERAs over 4, one of which with an ERA over 5, help you win the World Series. You can't depend on those guys to perform for you in the biggest game of their careers, arguably. So when you've got that problem, you're not going to win at all. The Dodgers, on the other hand, have such an influx of starting pitching. I mean, Clayton Kershaw is a future Hall of Famer, without a doubt, and has done great this postseason. And this year, despite injuries, went 9-5, 2.73 ERA. Walker Buehler, who I'm truly high on, especially after that performance in Game 7 of the NLCS, went 4 2/3 innings, gave up one run as a rookie. He got called up in July for crying out loud, and then goes out just a few months later, pitches in an incredibly huge game, and performs for the Dodgers. So Kershaw and Buehler are going to help. Alex Wood is a good pitcher too, but the Dodgers left him off the roster. They had him on. He went 9-7. Then you've got Kenta Maeda and Ross Stripling and Hyunjin Ryu. All three of those guys are going to either be starting or coming out of the bullpen in long relief, and all of them have done great. Hyunjin Ryu, by the way, 7-3 record in the regular season and a 1.97 ERA in 15 starts, and in the postseason, an ERA of 3.56. So he's performing well. Ryu has been reliable, and if you remember, Ryu was the game one starter in the NLDS on top of it. So it seems as if the Dodgers have more faith in him than even Kershaw at this point, because they're riding the hot hand and it's working out for them. Because remember this about pitching. Good pitching can always contend with good hitting. And for the Dodgers, they have good pitching. They have decent hitting. The Red Sox have no pitching and great hitting. So just by the simple laws of logic, if you've got the Dodgers throwing zeros, tossing zeros on the board and forcing the Red Sox hand, the Red Sox have got guys like Chris Sale and Porcello on the mound trying to deal to guys like Justin Turner and Cody Bellinger. That doesn't sound like a good recipe for success if you're the Red Sox. That's why, in my opinion, this is the Dodgers series to lose, without a doubt. And I feel that in 6 games, the Dodgers will end up taking this all and winning it all. I don't think it'll even go to a Game 7 because, again, the Red Sox don't have pitching. I don't know why people aren't realizing this and they aren't calling them out on this, but they should. If you've got no pitching, pitching and defense win championships. If you've got no pitching, you're not going to win the World Series, plain and simple. When you've got one good starting pitcher and the rest are horrible and the rest are, you know, average or mediocre, you're not going to get by. I can't think of a team in these past 10 years that have had a horrible starting rotation that have still ended up winning the World Series. Look at the Cubs in 2016. Lester, you know, Lackey, Hendricks that year won the ERA title. That was a team that won the World Series based on pitching, even when the offense cooled off. Jason Hayward that year hit horrible all year. Bryant and Rizzo in the postseason, both of them, a combined batting average under 200. And they still won the World Series because of their pitching and because of their bullpen. And that's another thing, too. In regards to bullpen, the Dodgers, a complete advantage. Kenley Jansen, Pedro Baez, Daniel Hudson, all have done great. And for the Red Sox, although they have Craig Kimbrell, one of the best closers in the game, they have no setup guy. They've gone all year without a setup guy, the Boston Red Sox. All year. Because Joe Kelly, an ERA over 4. Heath Hembree, an ERA over 4. Matt Barnes, 3.70. And Stephen Wright, the knuckleballer, 2.70, but they've been using him to start as well. So they've gone without a setup guy all year. It's hard for me to understand how they won 109 games and how they're in the World Series based on their dire pitching situation. I mean, it seems like they've been able to out-hit teams, and that's been the cause of their greatness so far, but I'm telling you right now, they're going to be severely humbled come the World Series when they have to face Clayton Kershaw and Hyunjin Ryu in Games 1 and 2. God forbid, I don't know what's going to happen in Game 3 when they have to face the kid Walker Buehler. It's not a good situation for the Red Sox, and anyone who tells you otherwise is completely wrong. So I think the Dodgers, they're going to win this World Series in 6 games, 4 games to 2. And even though it'll be a 6-game series, the Dodgers are going to dominate based on their pitching based on their bullpen and based on their decent hitting, which although is worse marginally than the Red Sox because of their pitching and their complete advantage in that aspect, they're without a doubt going to win this World Series. Wise decisions about your heart health start with good information. That's one reason a website was developed to help individuals create a personalized profile that covers factors such as high blood pressure, cholesterol, and coronary artery disease. It takes 20 minutes to create the profile, and the information is kept private. 20 minutes could be the investment of a lifetime. To learn more, visit www.americanheart.org/heartprofilers. So it's now time for the Sports Talk Chicago flashback, as each week we play for you an old interview that I've had before. This week, it'll be Ryan Dempster, the former Cubs pitcher who, ironically enough, won the World Series in 2013 with the Red Sox. So during the interview, I ask him about how great it was for him to win it all. And we also get into a hot topic, a time in which he beamed Alex Rodriguez directly after his suspension regarding steroids. And I asked Dempster the tough question of, was that intentional or not? And his answer is something that you're truly going to want to stay on and hear. So this will take us about 8-9 minutes. We'll come back after this clip, and we'll shift to basketball and talk about how LeBron James and the Lakers are a team of misfits, and how eventually you're going to see, you're going to find out why LeBron is going to continually start to cry about his team and compare it to his time in Cleveland this past season. So that's coming up soon, but until then, listen to Ryan Dempster and I have a candid conversation about his great MLB career, his World Series win with the Red Sox in 2013, and the time he intentionally threw at Alex Rodriguez. This is WHBK-FM 88.5. Time with the Cubs for a moment. You were the team's shutdown closer for 3 years in a row and did great. What prompted you to transition back to a starting pitching role in 2008, and how were you able to do so well in that transition?
I think part of it always inside before that was, being a starting pitcher. Starting in Florida, starting in Cincinnati, so I always had that drive and that desire to go back to the rotation, and then when Lou presented it to me that I was going to do it in 2008 and to go home that off season and get ready to do that. I always trained hard, but I think I put more physical effort into that off season than I ever had, because I knew how much that transition was, how much hard work it was going to be, how difficult it was going to be. And so I knew that physically I had to be ready. I figured mentally I could do it. It's just the physical aspect, and was able to slide in there nicely, make an all-star team my first year back, and then, stay there the rest of my career. But I had a blast doing both of them. The closing thing, sometimes it can be a little tough, but I enjoyed it, the adrenaline rush of it. But I definitely enjoyed the starting pitching and having those days in between starts and doing what I could there.
By the way, the Cubs team of 2008, the one where you became a starter once again, was quite a special one, with you guys winning 97 games and the NL Central Division title. Did you believe that you guys were capable of ending the Cubs World Series drought at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought the 07 team, we had a good team. But the 08 team, we were stacked, man. And we had all the pieces of the puzzle to get it done, and we didn't. And, a lot of that, the tone gets set in the first game. We got the Dodgers, and the Dodgers were playing great baseball going into that series. They were hot as could be and playing really well, but at the end of the day, the starting pitching in that series didn't pitch like we were capable of. I went out there, I walked 7 guys in that first game and gave up a big grand slam, and just never kind of got what we needed to get out of that. And then it just steamrolled downhill after that. But we were put together so well, a lot of depth, good balance, good bullpen, good rotation, and we just didn't get it done. But I thought for sure that was the time it was going to happen.
Now, although that 2018 did not win the World Series, you helped the Boston Red Sox win it all in 2013. So how rectifying was that for you, considering that you waited your entire career to get that ring?
Oh, my gosh, man. Just absolutely meant the world. And, when you get to the playoffs, you think you're just always going to get there and you're going to be there. And you understand and realize that those are hard to come by, and especially getting to a World Series and having that opportunity to get back there in 2013 with the Red Sox was so special. We had an unbelievable team, a great bunch of guys, really driven by the same thing, and that was winning a championship and nothing else, not by money or any of that stuff. So we just, we steamrolled some teams and completely, our plan was undeterred. We knew we were going to win it, and to go out that way and win a championship in my last season was pretty cool.
So in that 2013 season, you also did something that made national headlines. During a game at Fenway Park, you faced Alex Rodriguez at the plate and threw three straight balls on the inside part of the plate before hitting him. First off, was that intentional? And if it was, what was the reasoning behind it?
I like it. What a great question. I never heard that before. No, you know what? I think at the end of the day, just trying to send a message. I obviously wasn't happy with a lot of the things that, were going on in that whole situation. And to be honest with you, it started way before any of all that when I signed with the Red Sox. Me and my brothers were having a celebratory ice cold beverage together up in Vancouver. And I just said, hey, you know what I'm going to do? The first time I face A-Rod at Fenway, I'm going to hit him. That way I never have to pay for another beer for the rest of my life when I'm in Boston. And it worked out. Last time I was there, when the Cubs were there earlier this year, I didn't pay for any beer. So it is what it was. It was, one of those moments where, people say, do you regret doing it? And I say, no, we live with what we do. And I'm glad I was the guy who was able to put my foot down and say we weren't happy with what was going on.
So you ended up retiring after that eventful 2013 season, but made a comeback this past year in the World Baseball Classic as a pitcher for Team Canada. Why did you decide to make a comeback, and did you receive any offers to return to the MLB?
To decide to do it, I just, I always had kind of had this part of me that wished that I played in the WBC and just didn't before because of pitching in the regular season. For me personally, I just always was trying to get ready for the start of the season and didn't want to get ready too early. So, I just loved it. I thought it was so much fun to get ready again, to ramp up like that, and to show my kids too that if you want to try so hard for something and not be afraid, don't be afraid to fail. If you fail, so what? At least the opportunity to push yourself to do something and to do it after 3.5 years of not playing baseball like at all was a big challenge. But stuff wise, it was there. The game against the Dominican to open the tournament, so it was a tough draw when you're facing an all-star team like that, but a little bit crisper, a little bit sharper, maybe a pitch here or there, maybe the results would have been a little bit different, but no offers afterwards. But then again, I made it let known that I wasn't making a comeback of that sort. So I just wanted a chance to put Canada across my chest and see if I could help us win some ball games, and it just didn't quite work out that way.
So your career as a whole was one of success and longevity. I was wondering if it had something to do with your mechanics, because when thinking about your pitching mechanics, the mitt wiggle immediately comes to mind. It was something that was different, yet successful. So why did you wiggle your mitt in your delivery, and what purpose did it serve?
Yeah, it was actually kind of an interesting story. So back in spring training going into the 2008 season, we were in a situation where I had now all of a sudden for 3 years, I'd been thrown out of the stretch position as a closer. And I developed my split finger fastball. Well, I don't have big, huge hands that could just reach in and grab the split finger fastball. I'd have to preset it. And when I would come ready for the windup, I was throwing a bullpen one day and before spring training, and Tyler Colvin, one of our outfielders, said, do you mind if I stand in? And I said, no problem, get in there. And so I was throwing pitches to him, and he just came up to me and he said, hey, by the way, I can tell when you're not throwing a split anymore because your wrist moves. And so then I started wiggling my glove a little bit and doing that. And next thing you know, it kind of became the Dempster glove waggle. And, I remember walking by a ballpark one day in Chicago, a little school park, and I'm towing my son in the wagon. He's a young kid. And I just looked at him and I said, hey, some kid's sitting there going, I'm Ryan Dempster, and he's wiggling his glove. And I just looked at my son. I go, hey, he's talking about your dad right there. Look at that, huh? So it was pretty cool. I really, really neat, kind of interesting thing. I didn't do it for deception like people thought. I just did it to try and prevent people from seeing me tip pitches.
And finally, I just wanted to know if we could hear a bit of your insanely accurate Harry Carey impression.
Well, it's funny, man. Like, I love Harry. I kind of got a hybrid of actual Harry, a little bit of Will Ferrell from Saturday Night Live in there. But, you know, I enjoyed talking with Pat Hughes on plane rides and at the ballpark and having him share real Harry Carey stories with me, something that happened with Harry that, you know, and he would tell me different things. And he said, you know, before there was computers, we would have these stacks of papers that you would have to thank people. You had to thank sponsors, or maybe there was birthdays, or, you know, you're saying a happy anniversary to somebody, and they would have these stack of papers on the desk, and then you'd read them off, and you'd throw them away. And one day they took a yellow piece of paper, and they decided to mess with Harry. They wanted to kind of joke around with him, and they said, a busload of gerbils came to the game today. Well, they stuck the stack of papers in there, so they're watching it go on, and all of a sudden, you know, Harry's sitting there, and he said it was just classic Harry because you see this thing go on, and all of a sudden, he, you know, he's sitting there, run away, you know, the top half of the fourth inning. You know, we want to thank the Turbo family. They took a bus in here from Waukegan, and we want to thank them for coming by. And he didn't even miss a beat. And, you know, just the fact that he, the stuff that he would do, you know, and talk out there on the air. It was just, you know, saying hello. We want to thank Bill and Kathy Johnson, the old hardware store out there in Winnetka. Hey, Bill. Hey, Kathy. Thanks for being great fans. And he was just so lovable, and everybody obviously just adored him, and I'm one of those people, and glad I get a chance to relive him through my own impersonations and just stories of Harry Carey.
Well, what a great time that was with Ryan Dempster. Such a colorful personality. And it was really fun talking with him, catching up with him, trying to make sure he could come on this show in the future. So that'll be fun. Maybe we could get another dosage of that insanely accurate Harry Carey impression and also get some more stories. But great guy, great player in the MLB, lasted such a long time, 132 career wins, has a World Series ring, and played with the Cubs for a number of years. So great guy, great player, and so glad that we got to play that clip for you on the show today. So remember, you're listening to 88.5 WHBK-FM Chicago, and we just finished up talking about the World Series. We talked about the Bears earlier, LeBron James and the Lakers coming up next, but air your grievances and give me a call if you want to be heard on the air, or if you have a question for me, call at 773-702-8424. Again, that's 773-702-8424. It's now time for our signature segment here on Sports Talk Chicago called the Announcer's Call of the Day. So, for that clip, let's go back to the ALCS in 2018, this past year, as the Red Sox took on the Houston Astros. Now, in Game 4, the Red Sox led 8-6 in the ninth inning, but the Astros were threatening with the bases loaded. Alex Bregman was batting, and he hit a sinking line drive into left field. There were two strikes on him, mind you, and if this falls, I mean, who knows what could happen. The Astros would probably tie it up and end up winning the game. So let's listen to Brian Anderson from TBS make an amazing call, and listen in as Andrew Benintendi makes an unbelievable play as well.
Two outs. Kimbrel deals. Bregman in the air. Left field. Benintendi dives, and he makes the catch! Oh, what a play! Game saver! Andrew Benintendi! The Red Sox win on a spectacular catch by Benintendi in left field. Wow. What a game. What a finish.
Great call there by Brian Anderson, and what a play by Andrew Benintendi. I mean, that ball was sinking so quickly. He had to reach out with his left hand, dive, hit the pavement quite hard, and made a great play, saved the game, and most arguably saved this series for the Red Sox, and that explains why they ended up beating the Astros and, of course, are now in the World Series. Game 1 of the World Series tomorrow night as they face off against the Dodgers. But a great call there by Brian Anderson. Great, one of the best in the business, and you'll be hearing him soon now as the NBA season starts up. He does games for TNT, so you'll be hearing him on the airwaves very soon as well now that his time with Major League Baseball is over for the winter. So let's go to basketball, ironically enough, great segue there, and talk about LeBron James and the Lakers. You know, when you know that you're right and you know that you've told someone something, how good do you feel about it? Because when LeBron James went to the Lakers and then surrounded himself either through direct intervention or indirect intervention, because we all know wherever LeBron goes, he automatically becomes the coach and general manager. He surrounded himself with a team of misfits, as I like to call them. And I said from the very beginning that this wasn't going to work out. I said from the very beginning that they wouldn't be able to score points because they don't have shooters. And I said from the very beginning that this team was not going to perform well. They weren't going to make the playoffs as everyone predicted. Everyone said, yeah, they'll be a 5 or 6 seed. They'll make the playoffs in the very, very competitive Western Conference. No. Not a chance. And especially now after these first two games, I am more so convinced that the Lakers are not what everyone makes them out to be. In their first two games this season, you don't even want to know what the team's three-point percentage is. They're 15 of 62, translating to a 24% three-point percentage as a team. Because, again, the team is a team of misfits. They have guys like Lance Stephenson, Rajon Rondo, the holdovers from last year like Brandon Ingram and Lonzo Ball. That is not a team that I would equate or associate itself with success. There are too many conflicting personalities. Lance Stephenson is a character himself. Rajon Rondo, as we know from his days here in Chicago, is a horrible teammate. I mean, he single-handedly caused many problems with the Bulls in the locker room. Him and Dwayne Wade bumped heads every day. It was later revealed, at least. Lonzo Ball, now, he's not necessarily a problem himself, but his dad is. LaVar Ball's a problem. And although he's been quiet right now, you wait till middle end of the season, because he'll be talking it up again and causing misery for the Lakers. And then LeBron James, as we all know, whether you like him or not, whether you think he's great or not, he's a horrible teammate. He likes to hold people out to dry. I mean, we all remember the finals last year when J.R. Smith committed that error in judgment when he didn't know how much time was left on the clock and ended up shooting the ball. And LeBron right away didn't take any blame for himself, didn't say, oh man, you know, even though that situation was horrible, I could have played better. No, he blamed it right away on J.R. Smith. And the meme is circling the internet. It has been for some time of James holding his hands out and asking and yelling at Smith. Well, there's 1 second left in game one of the NBA Finals. He's sitting there yelling at J.R. Smith and asking him, what are you doing? Look, man, he made a mistake. Why don't you evaluate your own performance instead of sitting there and crying and yelling at your teammate? LeBron James is a horrible teammate. So when you've got LeBron, Rajon Rondo, Lonzo Ball, Lance Stephenson, you're not going to be able to form a comprehensive team with that group of guys. The team chemistry, and I'm surprised it already isn't, but it will be horrible. Too many conflicting personalities, too many guys who are too big for their britches are going to be colliding day after day at practice and in games. That's not going to work out for the Lakers, and it hasn't. They're 0-2 right now. They've lost both the games they've played in. That's just from a chemistry standpoint. Looking at their actual on-the-court performance, hasn't been great either. As I mentioned, 15 of 62 from three-point range. How in the world are you supposed to win a game in the NBA today? I'm not saying back then, I'm saying today, in a three-point oriented league, how are you supposed to win a game shooting 15 of 62? The Lakers made 8 shots in game 1, 7 shots in game 2. That means their average is about 7.5 threes per game on 31 attempts. So that's my problem with it. It's not like, okay, they're 0 of 8. 8 shots is nothing. But when you continually shoot threes and know you're not making them, know that you're making them 24% of the time, that explains exactly why you're losing. Every single possession, you're shooting inefficiently. You're being selfish on the court. That explains why the Lakers are 0-2 as well. I don't care about their paint game. I know their paint game is great. I understand that. But in the end, they haven't won a game yet. And that all goes back to their three-point shooting. When LeBron started to form his team in the offseason, once he decided to go to the Lakers, and I was wondering, you know, they signed guys like Rondo, you know, Stevenson, Michael Beasley even. I thought to myself, okay, that's great. What are they going to do in regards to three-point shooting? And how are those chemistries or those personalities going to affect team chemistry? Those were my top two questions. And everybody ignored it. No one cared. Everyone was like, this team's going to be great because LeBron's on it. That makes it great. Because LeBron's on the team, that makes the team great. Well, you know what? They aren't great right now. They aren't great right now. They're 0-2. So, yeah, I'm so happy that I was right. I'm so happy that I called that early enough. Because, you know, this team is not what they're all made out to be. Now, eventually, here's what you're going to see happen. So, let me take you now into the future. Number one, LaVar Ball is going to start talking, and it's going to completely disrupt the team chemistry. But number two, and this is more important, think about last year when LeBron was on the Cavaliers. And how he would always complain about having to carry the team by himself. Oh, I have to do this single-handedly. There's no one else capable of helping me out. Granted, he did have J.R. Smith, you know, Kevin Love. Love is an okay player, and besides him, he didn't really have much since Kyrie left, of course. But he complained about it right away. And when they lost the finals, everybody else chimed in and said, yeah, it's because LeBron didn't have anyone. He did the best he could. He's still the best player in the NBA. You know, he didn't have anything. Does that remind you of what's going on right now? He has guys like Lonzo Ball, Lance Stevenson, Rajon Rondo, Brandon Ingram, JaVale McGee surrounding him. How are you supposed to win a basketball game with LeBron James by himself and a bunch of mid-level, at best, players in the NBA? It's not going to happen. This situation is so similar, it's so comparable to the Cleveland situation, that I'm surprised LeBron hasn't opened his mouth yet and complained. Now, we are 2 games in. It's very early, to say the least, but you started 0-2. You know, there are glaring problems with this team, as I've mentioned, with chemistry and with three-point shooting. And LeBron's had to carry the team by himself. If you don't believe me, who do you think's the second leading scorer on the Lakers right now? Who would come to mind? Probably what? Brandon Ingram? Maybe Lonzo Ball? You know, you think of those guys right away? No, it's Josh Hart. And you know who's behind him? Only a half a point behind him, so, you know, very close in nature. You would never guess him. JaVale McGee. JaVale McGee's averaging 14.5 points per game. When you have JaVale McGee as your number 3 and close to number 2 scorer on the team behind LeBron James only, you have a problem. JaVale McGee is not a quality player. If he's your number 2 scorer, obviously you don't have enough players to sustain success. It's the same situation as LeBron was in Cleveland, and no one's recognizing that. And you have to start recognizing that. The team's already 0-2. They've got a tough schedule ahead of them. They can't shoot threes. They have too many different personalities, and McGee's another one of them. Add it to that list. You're not going to win many basketball games. And it just makes me wonder what was going through LeBron's mind when he decided to go to the Lakers. He could have went anywhere to win another championship. And I know that was a concern of his, especially thinking that, you know, the Cavs couldn't beat the Warriors. They only did once in 4 years. And LeBron's been to the finals 8 straight years and has won only 3 times. He's 3-6 in his career in the NBA Finals. So you'd think for his swan song, for his final 4 or 5 years in the NBA, he'd want to go to somewhere where he knows he can win a championship and lead a team to a championship. But instead, he chooses the Lakers. He's stuck with a bunch of random players, all of which are not anywhere near his talent level. And he expects to win something there. I don't understand that mind process, that thought process. You can't win when JaVale McGee is your number 2/number 3 scorer. You can't win when Josh Hart's your number 2. That's a guy who was benched the majority of last season. And you can't win when you've got your own guys starting fights on the court. Remember Brandon Ingram a couple nights ago? The suspensions were handed out. Ingram got suspended. Rondo got suspended. And by the way, Ingram is never a personality problem. This is what stymies me the most. But now, because he started that fight and caused a problem for the Lakers, you can add him to the list as well. You've got 7 or 8 guys with completely different personalities on that team, all trying to mesh together and win basketball games. That method is not going to work, and it hasn't, obviously. They're 0-2. So I don't get too high on LeBron and the Lakers yet, and don't sit here and tell me that, oh yeah, it'll turn around, because I'm telling you right now, the signs are there for this team to utterly collapse come midseason and end of the year. When you've got all those guys, when you've got a bunch of mediocre players who have huge personalities on top of it, those two things do not go together. That is not a recipe for success. And LeBron has to deal with that all by himself. And I know he put that on himself by deciding to get these players, but in the end, he's left alone, and now he has to deal with this for the entire season for the next 2 years, rather. So that's a tough situation there in L.A., and I wouldn't be surprised, as I said, if this team starts collapsing very soon. Well, that does it for us today here on Sports Talk Chicago. I hope you enjoyed the show. Had a great time talking with you about the Bears, about Los Angeles Lakers and the LeBron troubles, and some MLB World Series news and notes. Tune in next week at 9 a.m. Next week we're having Warren Sapp on, NFL Hall of Fame defensive tackle. So he's always a very fun interview. A lot of laughs, a lot of funny stuff, lots of stories that'll be exchanged. We'll also talk about the Bears and their game next week, the day after, about the Jets. So we'll talk about that. We'll also talk with Warren, and this is an interesting question that I can't wait to ask him, what he thinks of Khalil Mack, and is his comparison to Lawrence Taylor justified? Who better to ask than a Hall of Fame defensive tackle? So we'll talk to him about that. And we do have a late caller, so let's get them on the air real quick. Hello? Caller, you're on the air, 88.5 WHPK FM. What's on your mind? All right, maybe not then. The phone light was lighting up, but I guess not. So anyways, next week it'll be really fun. I hope you continue to join us next week, Monday, 9 a.m., right here on WHPK 88.5 as we talk about the Bears, we'll talk about the World Series, we'll talk about some Bulls news, and have Warren Sapp on the phone in the middle of the hour. So very fun time coming up next week. By the way, on November 9th, the University of Von Freeman, the new apartment lounge jam, is coming here to the Hyde Park area. The jam sessions that drew thousands over the last 30 years Von Freeman presided over had a huge impact on developing young artists over 2 generations. This specific recreation will include trumpeter Brad Good, saxophonist Ed Peterson, and other veterans of the new apartment lounge jam with young area college and high school students. So, sponsored by the University of Chicago. Make sure to check that out next week, November 9th, 2018. Well, again, that does it for us. Thank you for listening. You can find me on Twitter at John Z Sports, on Facebook at John Zagluel, where next week we'll also be broadcasting the show live on Facebook Live. And find me on Instagram at John Zags. To close today, we have a great song from TMMRW that's going to play. See you later. See you soon. and make sure to tune in next week.